You're not alone. Oh my God. How many times I was sitting there thinking I was the only person going through this, and how common it is. And not just, not necessarily just alcoholic parents, but people who abuse substances, all substances. You are so not alone. Oh my gosh. It's everybody around you knows somebody.
Dying of laughter.
Not funny.
My mom has stage 4 cancer in her bones and in her breast. My dad's disease was 15 years, he died of ALS. I made a podcast about death, seemed like the thing to do. And if you're sad by all of this, well, you're gonna die too.
Happy week, everyone. Wow, I feel like so much happened for me this week. And I'm not sure how much of it I will share, but essentially my mom had a not great day with her health, and I will share more about that later, but it was unfortunate and frustrating when that happens, especially when a person has been fine for so long and there's a hiccup in their routine and rhythm. I mostly felt really bad for her and that I wasn't able to be more helpful. So more on that later, but it's got me reflecting on some things this week. The stand-up show I did last week in San Diego was really cool. That's on my mind because I opened for someone for the first time, and I was really grateful for that experience, and to do 15 minutes and to have it go well in front of an audience was so magical. So I am grateful for that. And if you're in LA, this Friday, March 6th, there'll be a stand-up show at the Westin Bonaventure that I'm producing and emceeing for the Young Survivals Coalition. And that's the premier organization for women under 40 currently battling breast cancer or who are recovering from breast cancer, had breast cancer, friends and family, daughters, wives, sisters of those with breast cancer. So if you're in LA and want to check that out, it's at the Westin Bonaventure this Friday at 8 p.m. Today we're talking with Heather Ann Gottlieb. She's a friend of mine. I did her podcast, Dirty Girl, where she talks about the weird, funky things that happen with women's bodies and their strange experiences, and they get really raw and vulnerable, and I'm super into that. They are on the Hoo Ha Ha podcast network that Elizabeth Banks put together, so that's major. Heather Ann Gottlieb is opening up today about her mother and losing her mother to alcoholism. We're addressing mental health and how that played a part in her mother's life and how Heather is navigating that space today. It's a really raw, lovely look at how you can come out the other side and go to therapy as a way to take steps forward in your own life. And I'm just so appreciative of her story. And I hope it is helpful to those of you out there who have experienced something similar. Or if you have not, there's so much you can learn and take away from her story today. I certainly did. So let's get to it.
Heather Ann Gottlieb is an award-winning actress, playwright, and poet. She's a proud multi-hyphenate and can be seen in commercials, television, immersive theater, and slam poetry competitions around Los Angeles. Her feminist comedy podcast, Dirty Girl, was chosen to launch Hoo Ha Ha's podcast network in 2018. She co-created and co-produces Queen Fest, an annual International Women's Day variety show benefiting homeless women and children. She also regularly competes at Bootleg Theater's Write Club event, raising money for charity through literary blood sport. Holla for Heather Ann Gottlieb! She's amazing! She's amazing! The whole episode is about her bio.
That feels so weird having you be like... Look at these things you've done.
Well, it's so cool how we met. I was on your podcast, which is freaking rad. Could you tell us a little bit about the podcast for those who don't know?
Thanks. Yes, my podcast is called Dirty Girl. It is on Elizabeth Banks's Hoo Ha Ha network. It's about the disgusting things women do, embarrassing anecdotes, crazy stories about the time they shit in the shower, stuff like that. And we giggle about it.
Relatable. We talked about my hemorrhoids for the first time that we ever met, and we just went for it. So I was like, oh, this girl's cool. I feel comfortable. Let's just go all into that. And if anyone wants to hear about that, that will not be happening in this moment, but it's available on yours. So we can link that.
Yeah. That's exciting.
And then the next thing we did was Queen Fest. I saw they were holding submissions. I submitted. Such a great experience. And even though you produced it, you were not at the event because you were at South by Southwest. No big deal.
It's been a really great couple weeks.
How was South By?
So fun. You were in Austin, too.
I was speaking to an organization for girls who are losing their parent to cancer and or who have cancer. So it was really fun in a different way.
That sounds great.
Yes. But I would love to hear from you about how it went.
It was so fun. I was in HBO did this activation, which is like an immersive marketing type thing for Game of Thrones. So I was part of their big Game of Thrones activation where they recreated the Red Keep and brought in like 41 actors and 18 musicians and 18 singers and marketing people and all these creative designers and just recreated Game of Thrones essentially for the streets of Austin. I'm a huge Game of Thrones fan, so it was great.
That is so cool. Did anyone come up to you and say anything weird, like, and try and break the immersive wall?
Yeah, of course they did.
How'd that go?
I mean, we had a couple days of rehearsal prior to our opening where it was just about that and just getting, like, we had a dialect coach and we had people coming in and, like, really training, I guess, for that specific reason. The best part was when Henry Winkler walked through.
Love him!
And it was just really funny watching him, like, be in Game of Thrones world and like the Unsullied, like, you know, attacking him and him being like, oh my God. That was just very funny.
Who's your favorite Game of Thrones character?
Cersei.
I mean, that was just such a confident, quick response. And I love that you're just like, it's for sure Cersei. She is really badass.
I feel like it's a very polarizing opinion to have, but she is a female villain that isn't. How often do you see a female villain in all her evil glory without it being, like, comedic or without them being, you know, ugly in some way? And she's just, like, just the worst person in the world. And she's an amazing actress. And, oh, my God, Cersei. Yeah, for sure.
She's so unlikable. And yet we all love her / maybe want to fuck her. I went there. So I did a stand-up show last night and I made eye contact with an audience member only to realize it was Gilly. And it totally threw off my mojo. I was like talking about Instagram and I have this moment where I like imitate girls on Instagram and I just pick one person to look dead in the eyes. You know, you're like the ultimate fangirl after your show. You congratulate someone else. Like, that's how, you know, that goes. Well, speaking of Game of Thrones, there's a lot of death on Game of Thrones and there's a lot of death in this podcast. So do you like that segue?
Those are all my favorite things. Death in Game of Thrones and podcasts and segues.
Something I like to ask everyone is your goldfish moment. But what I mean by that is, do you remember the first moment where you thought about or conceptualized what death was when you were a child? For some people, it was their goldfish. Goldfish moment. Did your goldfish die? Goldfish moment. Did it make you cry?
That's a great question. I'd have to say probably my grandma died when I was in the fourth grade. And I think that's the first time you realize, like, oh, death. Oh, that means they're done and you don't see them anymore. And grandma doesn't cook you cookies anymore. And that's really sad because dad's sad. Because that was daddy's mom. I love my daddy and I want my daddy to have parents. So probably that, yeah. Mm-hmm. I did have goldfish that died, but I didn't really... That didn't make me cry.
Oh, see, I call it the goldfish moment, but I haven't actually spoken with someone yet who actually had a goldfish.
And I had, like, cats and dogs. So if they were going to die, that was going to be, you know, the big heartbreak. But a goldfish was like, okay, we'll go back to PetSmart and get another 99-cent goldfish.
What was your goldfish named?
We had two. They were named Star and Moon.
I mean, classic. Good for them. And now they're somewhere with the stars and moons. So it really came full circle.
And then we had other fish. And we had five fish. And then only all four of them died. And this is a weird story. Four of them died. And one of them was left. And we're like, well, it's going to die anyway. So we put it in the swimming pool. And me and my dog swam with the last goldfish, which is like cute. But that goldfish's last memories are just swimming as fast as possible because a giant golden retriever is trying to eat it. So, That's kind of amazing. That's a good memory for me.
I love that so much. Would love to hear a little bit about your upbringing, where you're from, who you lived with, and how you went from childhood through young adulthood and what it was like to experience loss.
All right. So I'm from Phoenix, Arizona. I had a two-parent household and a brother, and it wasn't immediately – it took me – how do I say this? I wasn't aware that my mom had a drinking problem until, I think, middle school, and that's when I started realizing all the funny things she was doing is because she was inebriated, and I started being more careful about the people I invited over to my house because I didn't know what they were going to find, and I was really embarrassed, and she would do very embarrassing things, and many times I tried to, you know, tell her to stop, and she was a very mentally ill person, and that's something I can see now. But as a kid, you're like, oh, what's wrong with me that mommy doesn't love me? You know, if mommy loved me, she would take care of me better. So in sophomore year of high school, my dad moved out because her drinking was that bad. And at that point, I wasn't able to leave fully. My brother was in college, and my dad moved out so that I could have a safe place to go to, but I still felt very in charge of my mother's health, and she was suicidal a couple times. There was a moment, I guess, where we went to Europe when I was 15, and she tried to get out of the plane over the Atlantic Ocean. There were moments she went to jail once because she was driving drunk when I was in a car seat in the back seat. She was very ill, and I had a really hard time, you know, separating that, and I felt like I was in charge of her. Part of that came from one time when I was in middle school. My dad called me and said, I'm not going to be home till late. Your mom threatened suicide. Can you stay home with her? Can you cancel your plans and stay home with her? So I just internalized that and was like, great, like, I'm in charge of mom. And that was in the eighth grade, I think. I took it upon myself to make sure she didn't die. So my dad moved out, and it was just me and my mom. And that's when the drinking got really bad. It was already bad, but it was very, very bad. And it would get physical. I would come home and we would just scream at each other, and she would try to hit me, and I would, you know, push her, and it was very bad. But I didn't feel like I could tell anybody because I didn't want to be forced to leave, because if I left, she would die. And the summer before senior year of high school, I asked my mom if I could have friends over to spend the night, and she said, no, why don't you go spend the night somewhere else? Around like 11 p.m., I ran home to like grab my phone charger. And I couldn't find my mom anywhere, but I knew she was home because there was like a candle lit and her phone was plugged in, and I just knew she was somewhere in the house. And so I like grabbed my things and I left. I come home the next day and the candle is still lit. Her phone is still left open, like something's off, and I can't find her anywhere. I start calling people up. Do you know where she is? Do you know where she is? Again, it's a woman with alcoholism, so her disappearing was pretty normalized in my life. Eventually I would find her, whether or not she was passed out behind the couch upstairs and she just had to wake up, or she was, you know, she just didn't come home that night because she was out with some guy or at her friend's house or whatever. But then that night my dad calls me and tells me her body is at the bottom of the swimming pool and she's dead, which was obviously awful. So I've been in, I can't think of the name. What's the name? Psychoanalysis, I think is what it's called. I go to therapy 4 days a week.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. And I've been doing that for 3 years and it saved my life. And I am on a path of healing and I am more able to openly talk about this and realizing that it's not my fault, even though a big part of me was like, I was home. I was literally home when she probably died. Like, I couldn't find her. I saw some ripples in the swimming pool, but I thought it was the wind, you know? So stuff like that has haunted me. There's just a whole lot of baggage that comes with being a child of an alcoholic and all the stuff you internalize, and me having to work through that, which has been very hard. But I'm privileged enough to get proper treatment, and it's been life-changing.
Wow. Well, I'm so in awe of everything that you're saying, and I have so much respect for you that you went through this and that you're committed to that level of care now. Really speaks to your character, and that's really admirable and cool that you're doing that. How old were you when she died?
17.
What was it like for you after the first couple of years after she died?
A lot of anger. So much anger. And it started coming out when, I mean, alcoholism is a family illness, so it affects the whole family and everybody deals with it differently. And everyone's like, oh, hush, hush. You know, everyone knew she had a drinking problem, but no one wanted to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And it was just impolite to bring it up. After my mom passed, I had so much rage at the people around me. How could they let this happen to me? How could they let me, you know, survive in this neglectful, sometimes abusive atmosphere? And all I wanted to do was talk about what happened. And my family was very much like, I started a blog and I started writing about these anecdotes that I had dealt with.
Amazing.
And my family would like anonymously go on the blog and tell me to take it down because I was like, what if my grandparents found out? And like, and it just became about protecting everybody else but me and me not being allowed to claim my trauma for their sanity purposes and their guilt. They couldn't deal with the guilt. So I had to be quiet. Mm. So I had a lot of anger. And I think I'm definitely less angry now. I'm working through it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to like totally put like take them off the hook.
Right.
But I do think enough time has passed that they're starting to deal with their own grief.
Mm.
And controlling me and controlling my grief isn't going to make their grief go away. Just because they can't deal with it doesn't mean, you know, that I shouldn't.
Mm. It's very true. And I think everyone's on such a different specific path with their grief. But it's interesting how the family unit, those paths of grief can intersect and intertwine and then pass and then be parallel and then cross at different places. How has your relationship with your other family members been as of late?
Really strong. Again, they've never formally apologized for what they did on my blog. Even though they know that I know it was them and I know that they know that I know, you know.
Wow.
It's just this big unspoken, which is part of the family illness of secrets and not being able to deal. But I know that they all carry guilt about not being able to protect me and not being able to protect their sister, because they lost someone too.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of guilt around that. And yeah, it's good, but it's not like open. They still can't openly talk about their feelings, which is a shame.
Yeah, I think that's so difficult when you want someone to be open about something and they're just not. Like, you can't force someone else to talk about something. So that must be challenging for you. And you were saying how you have found, was it a therapy program? Is that what you would call it? Or you said it was called?
It's a type of therapy.
It's a type of therapy. Okay.
So it's basically intensive therapy where you go multiple days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially you're condensing years of therapy into a year or 2 years, or, you know, because you're going so frequently.
I think that's amazing. Is that something that you took upon yourself to seek out, or how did you get introduced to this, and what has the experience been like for you?
My dad is a psychiatrist.
Oh, interesting.
So he was always trying to get me back into therapy But I was so busy. You see, I have a lot of projects going on, and that's probably me trying to push everything away in one aspect. And after I graduated from college, my depression just really was full throttle because there was nothing to distract me from my pain. And he, you know, helped me find a therapist that did psychoanalysis, which is different than cognitive behavioral therapy, which a lot of therapists do. And then my therapist suggested, you know, upping how many times a week I go, probably because he could see that I had a lot of shit to work through.
Yeah.
And my dad supported me because we're privileged enough to have the means.
Mm-hmm.
And my therapist was privileged or was able to like lessen the cost and work with us so that I could do this. And it's changed my life for the better.
Do you see the same person every day or is it different people?
It's one guy, 4 days a week.
My gosh, love. Yes, for this guy. I'm into this. This is amazing. And you obviously have a close rapport with him and you found someone that you really like. Is that the right word? Trust? Yeah.
It's just unlocking all these developmental issues and all these things that were stunted in my development because of all of my trauma. So I thought therapy was just dealing with your trauma, but it's not just that. It's all the other ways that it's affected your life and affected my ability to trust people, my ability to form healthy relationships, my ability to do XYZ. And now that I know it, I can work on it. And I'm very much like in my skin now and not as, you know, afraid, I guess.
That's really cool. So I think we all know, you know, there's some people that are really hurting and they haven't, for whatever reason, been able to or haven't wanted to or known how to seek out a safe space to uncover what is underneath. And that's, I find that challenging when someone isn't able or willing to uncover. So I think that's really, really amazing that you're doing that. What, with your experience seeing your mom go through everything she went through, is there one particular thing that stands out as being the most challenging? And is there one thing that sticks out as being perhaps uplifting or rewarding or something you learned about yourself that's interesting to you in some way?
It's difficult because it's somebody that I've had, someone has passed that I had a really difficult, complicated relationship with. It would be easier, I think, if I just loved her or if I just hated her.
Mm.
But it's someone who I both simultaneously loved and hated and brought me joy and an insane amount of pain. What was the question?
Sorry, no worries. I was kind of a long-winded, but I was wondering if there's one thing that stuck out as being the most challenging, and then if there was one nugget of goodness or a positive takeaway that you had. So a two-part question.
The most challenging thing would be I don't know how to There was a few moments when she was drunk where some borderline molestation occurred. And I don't feel like I can claim it as molestation because it wasn't, I don't know, I'm still trying to figure out how to deal with, you know, your mother touching your breasts when she's drunk. I just don't know how to work through that, and I'm working through that now. And that's been really challenging. And also just the, you know, like there's a moment where when I first got my period, she like sat me on the toilet and like forced a tampon in me and like made me spread my legs and like, you know, you remember how painful your first tampon was.
Mm-hmm.
It was her like shoving it in me and me crying and her not, you know, just very like challenging things to work through. And I have countless anecdotes like that. And those are hard to deal with. Those are hard to work through. Those are hard to talk about. And those are the types of things my family didn't want to hear because it challenged their experience of her. And I'm sure fed their feelings of guilt because I, you know. Yeah, so that's the journey I'm on to work through. And I guess the uplifting thing is that it's learning that it's okay to have mixed feelings and it's okay. I don't have to go through therapy to decide that I love her and totally forgive her and I'm done, you know? Mm-hmm. It's okay to feel both anger and love and joy and really miss her. Even though that sounds crazy when you hear all the anecdotes, but it's true.
Yeah. Thank you so much for opening up about that. So I know like that story could really positively impact and help someone who's going through something similar. And on that note, I was wondering what advice you would have for someone who might be in high school right now experiencing something similar.
I didn't find Al-Anon until senior year of college, which is the sister program to Alcoholics Anonymous. Al-Anon is for families and friends of alcoholics. And that was, I didn't know that was even existed. So if you're going through something similar, that is an incredible free resource. You can Google it and find five meetings within 5 miles of you because they're so everywhere.
Amazing.
And that was really, that was a big moment for me.
The Young Survivors Coalition annual YSC Summit is this weekend, March 6th through March 8th in Los Angeles. I'm so excited to be hosting and emceeing their first ever stand-up show this Friday, March 6th at 8 p.m. at the Westin Bonaventure downtown. If you're in LA and you would like to attend this comedy show, it is going to be amazing. The comedians are women who have had cancer themselves or who are supporting a close friend or family member currently battling cancer. And I couldn't be more thrilled to have helped produce and put this event together. So again, the Young Survivors Coalition annual YSC Summit is this weekend. Or if stand-up's not your thing and you know someone who is in the Los Angeles area who has had or has breast cancer under the age of 40, it is not too late for them to attend the conference. There's dozens of workshops, counseling sessions, breakout groups with other people in their age group who are currently going through a similar experience to them. There's food, there's shirts, it's so overwhelming in the best way. I went to their conference last year in Austin and it was so organized and amazing. And you walk into the hotel and there's signage galore. Basically, they take over the entire hotel and it's a Westin, so it's a biggie. If you or someone you know is interested, it changes cities every single year, so it might be closer to you then. Again, this is the Young Survivors Coalition annual YSC Summit. Summit.youngsurvival.org will show you all the information. Again, that's summit.youngsurvival.org. All right, back to the episode.
But if I had known that existed in high school, that probably would have been really a really helpful tool.
Do they have groups, do you know, specifically for people who are younger or in certain age brackets?
They do. They have the one I started in was at my university.
At LMU.
At right? LMU. Mm-hmm. And I was chatting with the doctor on campus because I went for a cold or something. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, told me to come in. And so I went every single week after that. So they have different... the Al-Anon website, if you just Google Al-Anon, mm-hmm. A-L space A-N-O-N. Mm-hmm. There's like young people's groups, so people under 40, people under 30. There's specific adult children of alcoholics, which I think pertains to me more than a spouse of someone who's an alcoholic.
Certainly.
That's just a different dynamic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried one in Tarzana, and that was, it was like 150 people there. And
wow.
It was way too many for me personally. I'm not going to. You know, versus I tried a young person's one and it was like 30 people there and they were all under 30 and that was felt better. But I still feel like I need a meeting that's adult children of alcoholics just because it is a different dynamic. And I have a judgment about, I guess, a different relationship than somebody who has a friend or has a spouse or has a sister, which is still incredibly painful, but it's just different.
Mm-hmm. Because you were really young when you first started to pick up on signs of her alcoholism. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like for you when you were, you know, in eighth grade? Did you know much about what alcohol was and what it did? And how did you come to terms with that? Was there someone you could talk to then?
She was a functioning alcoholic, which meant she would binge drink like once a month. Once every few months, as opposed to coming home every day and she's drunk,
mm-hmm.
which made me feel like, was it really alcoholism? You know, like not feeling like I can claim that and not feeling like my trauma's real because I'm not getting, you know, beat up every day by a drunk dad, you know, having an idea of what alcoholism is and just not having it match up. So my dad is a psychiatrist. He's a really intelligent person. And the way he described it to me, you know, tried to explain it to me, ended up doing more harm than good. You know, reasons why mommy may drink. Mommy had a lot of trauma growing up because she had a teenage pregnancy. And she, you know, had birth. She gave birth when she was like 14 or 15.
Oh, wow.
To my stepsister or half sister. Who's 30 years old, no, 18 years older than me.
Wow.
And it was very much like, oh, mommy drinks because she's has a lot of trauma from that. And you're growing up and you're almost the age mommy was when she got pregnant. So when mommy looks at you, she sees herself. And of course, I'm like, oh, great, I'm the reason mom's drinking, you know. Not at all what my dad meant, but that's a way young, confused kid interprets it. And just him trying to feeling like he was really explaining it away, like, oh, you know, I know she's drinking a lot, but it's because she has a lot of pain. And me feeling like, what about my pain? Yeah. Aren't I valid, everybody? So we've, you know, I've had to deal with my anger towards my father, too,
yeah.
which I didn't know I had until getting into therapy. And realizing, oh, there is some anger there.
Have you been able to talk to your dad more recently about all of this? Or is that still something that is in flux? And
yeah, we have a really healthy relationship now. We work really hard on it. I'm able to voice all these things and he's able to hear it. And also he's remarried to a woman who was also a child of an alcoholic. So if he doesn't get it, she tells him what's up. You know, like her and I have some similar experiences. So, you know, she stands up for me a lot of the time saying, well, of course, because you weren't there because, you know, and she's sort of like angry on my behalf in a lot of ways. So that's been a really like fortuitous meeting, I guess, of this woman who's in my life now, who loves me very much.
That's really amazing. So you have a good relationship with her, it sounds like.
I do, yeah.
That's really cool. Or I don't know if cool is the right word, but it's really something.
Special.
Special, yeah, meaningful. Do you have a relationship with your half-sister?
Mm-hmm. We don't talk super often because she's in Wisconsin, where my mother is from.
Okay.
But, you know, she met my mom. She reconnected with my mom when I was 6 months old. So she's always been in my life. And my mom was really struggling with having her a part of our lives. And again, my mom was also pretty mentally ill, but nobody was self-medicating. Nobody like really knew, or which is such bullshit. Everybody knew. Nobody was dealing with it. Mm. And she couldn't get help. She refused help, even though she was a nurse. And she, you know, it's all ironic. But my half-sister started cutting us out because she wanted so badly to be close to my mom. And her and my mom went on a trip. And my mom was really promiscuous, which we didn't find out until after she died, about all the people she cheated on my dad with. And in that trip, she, like, cheated on my dad with a woman in front of my half-sister. And my half-sister was really, like, confused and just sort of backed away at that point. And
wow.
Yeah. And that's always, like, my dad's thing. It was, like, if he knew that she was cheating on him, he would have left. But it's all, like, yeah. And a lot of people did know, and nobody said anything because it was a trust thing and manipulation and all things that could have been avoided if we communicated with each other, I think.
Oh, my gosh. Life is so complicated. It's fascinating. Something I ask myself, and I'm curious what you think. Why do you think it's easier for people to keep going about their day-to-day as opposed to opening up and asking these tough questions?
Fear of pain, fear of rejection. I know I was taught, my mom was a hard ass, and I was not taught that on the other side of vulnerability, there can be compassion and there can be love and acceptance. I was taught vulnerability gets you nowhere. You suck it up. You keep going. You shut it down. Buck up, she'd say to me. I'd be sobbing. She'd tell me to buck up. So I think a lot of people don't see value in vulnerability.
Is there some comedic aspect that you found either related to this experience or to grief in general? Any particularly funny or strange things? You're like, well, that was so something, I just have to laugh.
Well, I know when my mom died, I feel like when she died, I made a lot of dead mom jokes.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Trying to laugh because laughing was easier than crying, and probably on one level just not being able to deal with my feelings. I have this image of being at my mom's funeral and there being like an open casket, and my friends were saying something, and I was like, come on guys, not in front of my mom. Which is like really shocked everybody else but made me laugh. I try to laugh it off less as an adult, because it's not always funny. And it's the same thing with like self-deprecating humor, like just trying to step away from making fun of myself. There's probably a healthier way to deal with things. But sometimes it is just funny. Like, that was just a funny joke. Sorry if it made everyone uncomfortable, but I'm not sorry.
Mm-hmm.
How about you?
That's a good question. That really interests me when you said sometimes there's a healthier way. And I think as someone, you know, we're both artists and in the comedy space, it's a very interesting line. And it's a line that I personally really find myself pushing. I personally do go there. And I think it's really important to have an outlet and a safe space to be dealing with what's underneath.
Yeah, I agree. I think you can totally play with it as long as you're also dealing with it. I think a lot of people make jokes and that's it.
Yes. And it's so interesting. I see a lot of stand-up
shows. I do a lot of stand-up, and people that do bring up either illness, death, terminal illness, mental illness, really deep stuff, it's so fascinating to me because sometimes it's in really good taste and it's really freaking funny. And I'm like, that person is brilliant. And sometimes it's so raw and it's not quite there yet. And it's uncomfortable. It's like, wow, that person's really going through something right now. And I find it fascinating. And you know what? If it's helping them in that moment to go there, you know, there's something to be said about that. But
it helped me. I know it did.
Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's also so important to have a safe space. I think also, you know, in stand-up, when someone's like, so when my mom died last month, whew, I'm immediately, I'm like, okay, last month, it's just, it's so raw that I find it uncomfortable. Whereas, like, my dad, it's been 8 years, and I just started bringing it up in stand-up. And it's far enough away that there's this distance. But even then, you know, comedy can be offensive, and everything could offend someone in some way. And I think we all know people that, like you said, that are just self-deprecating all the time. And it's past the point where it's funny. It's to the point where you're like, okay, that person is lacking self-worth in some way, which is hilarious. No, I'm just kidding. So, yeah, yay for comedy and therapy, but especially therapy. So to wrap it up, before I ask you a couple questions about your career and what's going on next for you, I was thinking if there's any last takeaways that you wanted to share about your experience. And you'd mentioned advice before that I thought was really valuable. So if someone has an alcoholic parent right now, any last words for that person?
You're not alone. Oh, my God. How many times I was sitting there thinking I was the only person going through this and how common it is. And not necessarily just alcoholic parents, but people who abuse substances, all substances. You are so not alone. Oh, my gosh. It's everybody around you knows somebody. And I know there's a lot of shame associated with the illness that you may not talk about it. You may not bring it up. But there are so many people that want to hear your story, that want to help you, that want to give you tools to help yourself. You know, one of the, I can't remember the steps of Al-Anon is don't be a doormat. And, you know, stop taking that shit, which is you can't always do if you're dependent on that person. So I know that's really challenging. But I see you, and you're not alone, and your pain is valid. And just find a community, create community. You are loved.
I love that you've said that. It's so powerful, man. But could you talk a little bit about how your experiences have influenced advocacy work or your work in the artistic space and what that's been like for you?
Theater's been really important to me because that was just my outlet as a child. I did a lot of community theater growing up and then high school theater, and then I studied theater in college. And I just believe in creating and working on projects that you're really passionate about and empowering others. And I don't know if that must come somewhat from my trauma. It has to. It's all connected.
It has to be from your trauma, Heather. You can't enjoy theater unless it comes from something. I'm just kidding. Totally not funny.
Yeah. But like specifically like advocacy work and stuff like that. I think I know what it feels like to feel shit. I can't eloquently put this. I just want to help everyone. I don't want other people to feel like shit and not be treated badly. And how can I help? Because I've experienced some shit, and this is so vague because I don't think any of the work I do like directly for the people that feel like shit hotline. I don't know.
This got me thinking about a whole thing. If your theater doesn't come from drama, is it really theater? I don't know, guys.
What's theater without a little drama? See, these are the jokes that I resonate with. I really am doing this conversation to get to these good puns. Just saying. And what's coming up for you, and where can people connect with you online and social media? I want to hear about your podcast, Queenfest. Let's hear about it all.
You can find my podcast, Dirty Girl, anywhere you get podcasts, on iTunes, on Apple Podcasts, off of Hoo Ha Ha, Spotify, SoundCloud, you know, all that good stuff. At Dirty Girl Pod is the handle for that. Or to follow me, my handle is at Heather Ann Gott, two T's, two N's, Heather Ann Gott. I guess, oh, season two of Dirty Girl drops in April on Hoo Ha Ha. And so we're working on that. You'll hear your voice.
Yes, her podcast is super cool. I was binging it the other day and before I came, and it's really raw and authentic and interesting. So if you like hearing about authentic stories about women's bodies, you're going to love it. And if you don't know if you like it, you will. That's what I have to say about that. It's super cool.
Thank you so much. And my head is shaved, which when I shaved my head, the industry was like, oh, now you're interesting. And then they started casting me.
Could you talk about what it was like shaving your head and what that's meant for you personally and professionally?
I just always wanted to do it. And everyone in my life was like, you can't, you're an actor. And I was like, you're right. And then finally last year, I was like, man, I'm not going out anyway. Like, fuck everybody. I'm just going to do it. And then I shaved my head. And then, oh, guess who's finally getting jobs? Like, which is like great because I'm stepping into myself and being rewarded for it on one hand. And the other hand, it's like, fuck you guys. I was interesting before.
Fair, man. Have you found that kinds of roles you're going out for are totally different?
They're totally different and they're way better because before it was just underdeveloped girl next door, female ingenue, you know, exists only to further the man's plot.
Great. And by that I mean not great.
Yeah, so now it's just more specific, edgy, weird, which is like, yeah, I'm edgy and weird. Let's do it.
I love that. I think that's really cool. And, like, some people shave their heads, but a lot of people dream of doing something like that and have never actually done it. You've freaking done it. I think that's incredible and incredibly cool. Truly, I am not, like, saying because it's a podcast. Fuck the podcast.
She's lifting her hands up to emphasize, and it makes me feel validated.
I love that we just – I'm like – I think it's fantastic. I would think it would feel so freeing, and I would love to donate my hair to an organization at some point. But here I am, a person that says it. I haven't done it, so I can't claim it, and I'm just going to put it out there. I think it's fantastic and inspirational, and I feel one step closer to – greatness because of you.
You can touch it if you want. It's real fuzzy and cute. Except it gets cold. My wee little head gets so chilly.
And now is the part where I pet Heather's head. So on that note, we should just thank you so much for talking about this really deep, profound subject matters. I really appreciate it. I know it's going to impact a lot of people. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for hydrating me. Stay safe. Namaste.
I'm gonna pet Heather's head now. Fade out. Bloopers, 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 bloopers. Bloopers. Yes. A plane and a burp. Good segue. Okay.
Chorizo burrito.
As you were saying.
Intro and outro music is by Liz Full. The cover art is designed by Austin Ray, and the photography is by Naomi Christie. Produced and edited by your girl. That's right, it's an all-female team. Austin is a girl. Holla! Yodo, you only die once.